Welcome to Our Hen House. This is Jasmine Singer.
And this is Marianne Sullivan.
And we're so glad that you have joined us this week because Marianne's guest is super special, really incredible advocate, Carolina Galvani, who is the founder and CEO of Synergia Animal International. She is going to be telling us what's happening for farmed animals and veganism in Brazil and elsewhere in the global south. And I am so excited.
This was a really thrilling interview for me because we just too often don't hear from what's going on in other countries, and particularly in the countries in the global south. And there's a lot going on, and that is due to a substantial part to work like Synergia Animal's doing. And it really made me feel really good to hear of all that's going on. I continued my conversation with Carolina on this week's Flock Bonus segment, and I'm sure you'll want to hear that as well. And if you're a Flock member, you'll get the link to that bonus segment in your email on the Tuesday after this podcast goes up. You can always find it on the Flock Facebook group. And if you're not a member of the Flock and you can afford it, you can join for $10 a month at ourhenhouse.org/donate.
And if you are a Flock member, please also join us for our first Flock Friday Zoom calls, which are once a month now at 4 p.m. Eastern, and they are expanded. They're pretty cool. We had our first Flock Friday after shorter ones with a different setup recently, and I thought it went really well. We focus on how to be better activists, how to take care of ourselves and each other, and we talk to former podcast guests for a more in-depth, more intimate sort of conversation about what's going on for them.
We ask them all sorts of embarrassing questions and try to reveal intimate secrets.
Right. That's what we do. We try and catch them so that they accidentally tell us something they didn't mean to. That's the ethos of our hen house. So if you're a member of the Flock, check out the Flock Facebook group for updates or write to us at info@ourhenhouse.org. So as we're recording this now, I don't know about you, but I'm exhausted, but like not a bad exhausted, a super intrigued exhausted, but also feeling really spent. What do you think?
Well, I think that you did a long intro about how tired you are, which I'm sure thrills everybody. So maybe you should get into the reasons.
Because we did a giant whirlwind one day, like 14-hour trip the other day to Rochester, which is obviously a small city that is in Western New York, way up by Lake Ontario, which we saw because there's beach there and there's downtown there and there's a really kind of thriving activist ethos there. Someone I know referred to it recently as like Portland in the 90s, which felt about right to me. And that was cool. I had such a great time looking around in Rochester and discovering that city. I can't believe that I've lived in New York for most of my life and hadn't really been there.
It really is the problem of being in a state where New York City is, because you just kind of, it has such a strong magnetic force, you just kind of never get out of it. And I've never really been in Rochester either, and I loved it as well. And I feel sad that I was up until now unfamiliar with it. And they have all these great vegan restaurants. And that we went to that vegan donut shop, but it wasn't just a donut shop. They had like these crazy sandwiches. It was a very indulgent meal. It was so good. Misfits.
Right. No, totally. Misfits. Yeah, Misfits is like an animal rights vegan place too. It's not just vegan. It's like it is based in a care for our sometimes feathered and sometimes four-footed friends who we are trying all to create a better world for. Hence our hen house and hence Misfit Donuts. So that was cool. There's also a restaurant we couldn't even get into called Red Fern because it looked like, you know, lots of outdoor seating and we were going to get takeout, but it just looked like so busy that we didn't even try, but I am looking forward to trying that sometime soon. And I really enjoyed getting up there. It's still weird to go out in the real world, but we did so very carefully and of course are fully vaccinated and wore our masks, but it does seem to have a strong vegan presence. And I don't know if I sometimes don't know if I'm making that up because I'm hyper-focused on the vegan scene and anywhere I go.
You think? I think that is possible. You know, you go someplace and you go on Happy Cow and you go to all those restaurants and you're like, oh my God, there's so much vegan food here.
Right.
But you kind of skip like the 90%. I don't want to sound depressing. I just think that one has to remember what bubble one is in.
One does remember that. But I do also think I'm onto something. I mean, I don't think I'm onto something. I think Rochester's onto something.
Well, I did notice in reading about Rochester that there's some kind of hot sauce that's very common there. I'm not sure. It might be called Michigan. I don't know a lot about it, but I did notice that somebody said it has meat in it. They put meat in their hot sauce.
That's just hilarious. Saying. That's horrifying, not hilarious, but like, why? It just makes me feel like some people just want to put meat in like whatever they can sneak it into.
Maybe we should make some vegan meat-based
hot sauce. That's
maybe that'll be our big business.
I bet it doesn't exist yet.
I bet it doesn't.
And I thought everything did. So great. Well, let's trademark that now. Anyway, that was fun.
It was fun. It seems like a great city. I was charmed. It's very small. I mean, well, we were comparing it to Portland, but it's much smaller than Portland. It's maybe a third of the size. And as you said, it has these gorgeous beaches on Lake Ontario, which you can probably use for like 2 or 3 weeks of the year because it is pretty far north. But, you know, climate change, that'll change.
Well, I was actually really reading all day today about, well, not all day, but at some point today, I was reading about Rochester being like one of the biggest climate-friendly cities in the future, just sort of based on future projections. It does have the risk of extreme rainfall, but a lot of other places have the risk of, you know, rising like sea levels.
Wildfires,
right, exactly. And hurricanes, and it's very, and extreme heat, it's very scary, but every place has something. But Rochester also sort of has the infrastructure based on the fact that it was created for a bigger population than is there. It has the infrastructure for building the population, and it seems like it's a very good place for long-term climate projection.
I think for a while it fell on hard times because everybody there was employed by Kodak, and then, you know, iPhone started and that was a problem. But yeah, it seems to be coming back. All right. I'm not sure that has anything to do with animals and anybody is interested in that. So,
well, let's switch gears to something that hopefully people are more interested in that does actually explicitly have to do with animals, which involves the Non-Human Rights Project.
Yeah. And actually, some of you may have heard of this because it happened a couple of weeks ago, but we haven't gotten around to mentioning it because it kind of hasn't happened yet, but it's a very, very big deal. And that's the Non-Human Rights Project has been pursuing these cases in New York and Connecticut so far. The Connecticut ones kind of haven't gotten anywhere, but the New York ones, they haven't won, but they've had some interesting developments. And the case that is still pending involves Happy the Elephant, who is at the Bronx Zoo of all places, which you know, would think would not be the worst of conditions for animals, but apparently is pretty bad. Happy lives by herself. Her companion of many years, Groucho, I think his name was, died. And since then, she, for reasons which I think are pretty murky, she hasn't been put in with the other elephants. She's just been by herself for a long time now. So her conditions of confinement are not great. And the Non-Human Rights Project, which of course brings these petitions for habeas corpus against people who are imprisoning animals, has brought one on her behalf, and it has wended its way through the New York courts and has not been successful, but it was just granted leave to appeal to the Court of Appeals, which in New York is the highest court in the state and is a very prestigious court. And they did not have to take this case. They pick and choose which cases they are going to hear, and they chose to hear it, which is so interesting. I just can't wait to find out what happens. It's gonna make a lot of press because the Non-Human Rights Project has been very successful at getting press and bringing attention to its work on behalf of individual imprisoned animals. And also, I think one of the reasons it might have gotten accepted by the court is that in a prior case, one of the judges on the Court of Appeals made a very, very wrote a very, very sympathetic decision about whether we should be reconsidering our relationship with animals. And it was just fascinating that this judge took that position. I'm sure he was influential in deciding to hear this case. And also, the lower courts have made they've made a mess of things because they have used some very weird rationales to deny Happy's petition. I mean, at some point, they just say, well, she's an animal, which, you know, is not really... So considering that the whole case is whether animals are entitled to habeas corpus, you don't just say, well, she's an animal. You have to say why then, because that's what they're saying. Well, animals are entitled. And then the other reasons they gave why were really bad. For example, one was that she can't be entitled to release from imprisonment because she wouldn't be able to be just released. She has to be cared for somewhere. And that would prevent like children or people who are not legally competent from ever being granted habeas corpus, because they can't just be released out onto the street either. And so that's terrible law. They can't leave that as the law. So this case is fascinating. If I'm going on and on and on and on about it, there's so many cool issues here. I am excited. Are they going to win? Hard to imagine, but you know, these days you don't know. Anything could happen. And even if they don't win, having this discussion at that level and having them struggle with how really to deny that Happy has all of the attributes of anyone who is deserving of their freedom. And, you know, of course, she wouldn't be released onto the street, but she would be released to a place that was put there to care for her, a sanctuary, not a place that is not prioritizing her needs. I can't wait.
It's adorable when you nerd out in this particular way. It is so amazing to see the work that the Non-Human Rights Project has done over the last, you know, 10, 15 years. It is mind-boggling the level of mainstream success that this organization has had, especially with like, I mean, look what it's called, right? Like, it's so, it brings me hope. Sometimes I lose the thread, even though this is what I do for a living. Sometimes I lose the thread of what effective advocacy is, because sometimes it can feel like we are just living in our bubble and everything we're noticing feels gigantic, but in the big world isn't at all, making even more than like a little tiny blip. But then I think of projects like NHRP and I'm jostled out of my despair. So
that's, well, that's good. If it's done nothing else, it has gotten you to be less despairing, which is always a good move. And I was actually just talking to somebody, another lawyer, about, and it wasn't even in the context of this, it came up in a totally different context, but of, I don't know, 20 years ago, I would read these crazy, long, complicated law review articles that Steve Wise was writing with all these references to these ancient English writs that nobody's ever heard of. And I would have thought at that point, well, this is really interesting, but really, this can't go anywhere. And look how wrong that was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Getting a case accepted to be heard at the New York Court of Appeals is, that's something.
Well, I think we should go to the interview now, because it is also someone else who will jostle me out of my despair, which is our new benchmark for guests.
We're setting it low.
That's funny and not funny at all. I'm despairing again. Get me out of it, Carolina. Carolina Galvani, who hails from Sao Paulo, Brazil, has worked in over 30 different countries as an investigative journalist for leading NGOs such as World Animal Protection and Compassion in World Farming. She was also a senior campaign manager at Humane Society International Brazil and was the Latin American campaign director for farmed animals at Forum Animal, Brazil's largest animal protection network. In September 2017, Carolina founded Sinergia Animal, an international animal protection organization working in countries of the global south to reduce the suffering of farmed animals and promote more compassionate food choices. She will be joining Marianne right after this.
If you like what you're listening to, and I hope you do, then please consider taking a minute out of your day today to leave us a friendly review. You can do it on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify or Stitcher or on Facebook or wherever you listen to podcasts or wherever you're listening to this. The more we get out there, the more our hen house will be in front of people's eyeballs when they're putting in search terms in their podcasts, and the more we could join forces together to elevate the voices of the animals and change the world for them. So thank you so much in advance for leaving us a friendly review.
Welcome to our hen house, Carolina.
Hi, thank you so much for having me here. It's a great pleasure to be here with you today.
I'm so excited to hear about all of the work that you're doing, not just in Brazil. I think you're located in Brazil, but you're working in many countries. And one of your slogans, I don't know, is created in the global south, dedicated to the global south. So I'd just like to start off by asking you, why did you feel the need to found an organization that exclusively focuses on farmed animals and in the global south?
Sure. So basically, between 2013 and 2017, I was working with campaigns targeting big food companies to implement welfare reforms in Brazil. And the work was very exciting because we were able to secure many victories, but somewhat I felt frustrated because I noticed that a lot of resources were being invested in helping farmed animals in Europe, in the US, and in some key countries from the South, such as Brazil and Mexico. But other parts of the global South were being kind of ignored. So as we know, factory farming has spread everywhere now, and animals need help everywhere too. And that's why I decided to found Sinergia Animal, and we started working in Latin American countries where few or no other well-resourced organizations were working. And I also thought that globally, the movement was mostly led by organizations founded and working in the North. And we speak a lot about diversity nowadays. And if we want to be diverse and if we want to see a truly global movement emerging, we need to have strong organizations originating and working in the South or in the developing world as well.
Yeah, well, I really want to get into this because I find this very exciting. But the Global South is a big place, so You haven't quite taken over the entire thing. What countries are you currently operating in?
Sure. So we operate in 6 different countries, which are Brazil, Argentina, Chile, Colombia, Thailand, and Indonesia. So we are working in Latin America and in Southeast Asia nowadays.
And one of the things that it's so important, the kind of work you're doing is so important, is that we all hear that the consumption of animal products is increasing in the Global South and in the developing world. And so even if by some miracle in the North, we were able to slow things down, the number of animals being consumed is obviously going to increase dramatically as we see people's incomes rise, and we want to see people's incomes rise. So do you think that there are still opportunities to halt or slow down this growth, or is it all a matter of just trying to fix what's already happened?
Yeah, I think we have some opportunities, but we also have a very big challenge. So when we look at the Global South or developing countries, nowadays we still have many countries where people mostly eat plant-based. Of course, that is especially true for some Asian countries, for example. So of course, they eat animal products, but they're still eating more plant-based and the consumption is much lower than it is in the North or in the developed world. So I think there is an opportunity there because the diets and the habits are not so heavily dependent on animal products. And for example, the demand for practical and very fast meals is not so high. We see a lot of people who are still used to preparing their own meals and they're less reliant on ready-to-eat meals or fast food, for example. And we think that this creates a healthier relationship with food and cooking, and it can provide the benefits of higher consumption of fresh vegetables, grains, and beans, for example. But as you said, of course, that is changing, especially in bigger cities and households with growing incomes. And also in many places, consuming more meat and dairy products is seen as a symbol of status and wealth in the developing world. And when families have enough income to buy more of these products, they will do so. So while many plant-based diets still exist, we also have the challenge for veganism because habits are changing and they're changing quite quickly. So what we do is that we pay a lot of attention to the affordability of vegan products. Unfortunately, many vegan options use costly ingredients or ingredients produced by small companies in small quantities and sometimes sold in specialized shops. So the scale of production and distribution is so small that there is no economy of scale really for vegan products in the countries where we are working. So high prices can be very problematic, especially when we talk about low and middle income countries. And in many places, for example, that's very clear in Brazil, people already think that they cannot afford a vegan diet because they have to buy many fancy or expensive products. So regularly, we try to change that perception in our communication and education materials, for example. And we focus on providing recipes and tips for cooking that are simple but delicious and not expensive, and also using local ingredients. And we see that as a very strong need, because otherwise we face the risk of veganism becoming a trend that only the elite can afford. And our mission should be to make it accessible for everyone, or to everyone.
Yeah, and we hear this spoken about so many times. And one of the points that one of my guests made, which really stuck with me, is that much akin to what you're saying, though basic vegan foods have been the part of so many cultures for so long, they require cooking. And we ignore the fact that people not only be able to afford the money for the food, but the time, because people who are poor or even middle income, sometimes they're working very, very hard in many jobs. And the speed of food is also important. And the packaged vegan foods that you refer to can be so expensive. And he was pointing out that the cheapest food is the grilled meat on the corner, which is fast food, lots of calories, keeps you going. So the competition among different types of food gets even more complicated when you add in these factors. And before we get into some of those details, I'd also like to talk about the many international coalitions that are working towards similar goals for animals that Synergia is part of. And a lot of these are rooted in effective altruism strategies. And so can we talk a little bit about these coalitions? Because I think so many people in this country are not really aware of how many worldwide coalitions are being formed. One of the ones that I think is a really important part of your work that you're part of is the Open Wing Alliance. And can you tell us a little bit about that and how you coordinate with them?
Sure. Yes, indeed. The Open Wing Alliance is a very important coalition. So currently, I think there are over 70 member organizations from different parts of the world. So we work together, for example, on global campaigns, asking major food companies to phase out the use of battery cages in the egg industry. And they are greatly coordinated on an international level. So like we have channels where we communicate often and we join forces at the same time and work on these campaigns together. And also regionally, we also have many meetings and we talk to the groups who are part of the coalition often. And we share knowledge, strategies, resources, and sometimes we work on regional campaigns together as well. And another very important thing is that the Open Wing Alliance provides training and small grants for small organizations that are starting to do this type of work. So we are seeing them helping and empowering a lot of organizations in Latin America and now more in Asia as well. And that's very exciting to see. It's a great initiative, I would say.
Yeah, just any kind of internationalization of this movement is exciting to see. I've always thought that animal advocates, like we're sort of a nation unto ourselves, that, you know, anywhere you go in the world, you're going to find some people who get it about animals. But sometimes in your own country, one is surrounded, you know, well, wherever you are, one tends to be surrounded by people who don't get it about animals. So this kind of coordination is very, very exciting. There are a few other coordinations like this. One is specifically Asian, I think, Asia for Animals. I had not heard of them before.
Yes, we are also part of Asia for Animals, the coalition. I think currently they're more focused on domestic and wild animals, but they do a lot of great work as well. I think the coalition is very active and we receive requests to help other organizations all the time, and all the times that we ask for help and support, the other members were there as well and they were very supportive. It's quite exciting to see that we are seeing now more members of this coalition start working with farmed animals too. So it's coming and it's very exciting.
And what is 50 by 40?
Yeah, so 50 by 40 is a coalition of many different NGOs and not only animal protection NGOs. So there are NGOs who are focused on environmental issues, their social justice, and some other causes. And what they have in common is the very clear mission to reduce meat consumption globally. And the goal is quite challenging, but it's also very exciting. The goal is to reduce meat consumption by 50% by 2040. So that's where the name comes from. So in my opinion, it's a very strategic type of work, because actually we are bringing different allies together to work towards the same goal. And there are not only animal protection organizations. They have other causes, but we share this common goal. So it's quite exciting to see too.
And not to keep listing these, I promise this is the last one, but I just really want to lay this out because I think it's exciting for people to hear about this. But there's the Coalition for Aquatic Conservation, and that obviously brings up the issue that has for so long been ignored by too much of the animal protection movement and you know, aquatic animals, fish, and sea life. And can you just tell us a little bit about them?
Yes, we joined that one very recently, and that's mostly because, especially in Thailand and Indonesia, the consumption of seafood and fish products is higher than the consumption of land animals, for example. So it's very relevant for our work. And this year we are planning to conduct research to find out about what's going on in terms of fish farming in these two countries. And we're pretty much learning. It's a new area for us to understand, like, the key indicators of fish welfare, how we can work with governments or companies to improve fish welfare. But overall, would say it's still a kind of unknown area for us, and we are learning. But as you said, it's very needed because it has been neglected for some years, and it's time to do it. When we think about the principles of effective altruism, for example, we know that the number of individuals, when we talk about fish farming or even just fishing, is much, much bigger than the number of individuals we have with land animals, with factory farmed animals. So it is a new area. We still have lots to learn, but we are excited and we will start soon.
Yeah, that makes total sense that moving into Asia really does not only changes the place that you're in and the people that you're dealing with and the languages you have to learn, but actually the kinds of animals that people eat. And sure, fish and sea life are huge, huge food sources there. Hi, there's a lot going on. But you have, getting back to the local front, no, this isn't just local. This is in other countries as well. You've managed to obtain some big promises from some big players, I understand. I assume this is mostly in the cage-free campaign. And can you tell us, is it just cage-free? Is that the main way you are approaching corporate players? And where are you in the process? Have you just obtained promises? And do they have a long lead time? And when do you expect them to come to fruition?
Sure. So in five countries, so in Argentina, Chile, Colombia, Thailand, and Indonesia, we only work with cage-free campaigns. So we only work in the egg industry. I think overall, what I would say is that there is a kind of strong consensus internationally that that's the first area that everybody should focus on. And there is a lot of momentum from all the major global policies that we are being able to secure. So we have a very positive environment to talk to companies and say, listen, there are many multinationals that have already adopted these policies, and we know you can do something similar on a national level. So yes, we mostly work with cage-free commitments. We are at the very beginning, I would say. Although we have some very important companies committed in these countries, we don't have a lot of policies yet. When we look at the US or Europe, for example, there are many more policies and the change is much more advanced than it is in the countries where we work. So basically, we are in the stage of securing enough commitment to also provide the right conditions for cage-free producers to exist, because if there isn't enough demand, it's unlikely that anyone is going to be interested in producing cage-free eggs. So that's why we work with companies, because we know they can create that demand and we know they are the right players to start the process. But having said that, we are also very concerned about the fact that if we don't do anything after we secure these commitments, it is unlikely that they're going to be implemented. So in Latin America, for example, we are already working with a tracking program. So once a year, we send a survey to the committed companies asking them where they are with the implementation process. And we publish the results. And we also name the ones that are not reporting any progress. And we are going to start doing the same next year in Asia. And in Brazil, because our mission is to work only in neglected countries or neglected areas. So in Brazil, we have many other organizations already working with cage-free campaigns. So we don't work with cage-free campaigns in Brazil. So in Brazil, we are focusing on pig welfare and dairy cattle welfare. We are asking the major players here to implement reforms, for example, with pigs, to phase out the use of gestation crates and the practice of mutilations. And in the dairy industry, we are asking the major processing companies to stop the killing of male calves, the use of antibiotics, and the use of mutilations as well.
Now, when you do these campaigns, are you working with the producers or are you working mainly with retailers to get these products out of their supply chain?
Yeah, for cage-free, we mainly work with retailers, food manufacturers, and fast food chains. So we don't work with producers directly. But for pigs, for example, the major producers in Brazil, they're also major retailers. They have very famous brands and they sell their products directly to the consumers. So we work with producers instead of working with retailers because it's more direct and it's possible to do it. It's more viable to do it than it is to do it with eggs. Mostly because with eggs, I would say that eggs are a commodity, like the brand doesn't matter. There is very little difference between different types of eggs, or at least caged eggs. They're all the same. So the producers don't really sell or don't really have a brand or a strong presence in the consumer market. So it's harder to work with them than it is to work with retailers when we work with campaigns, right?
Yeah, I can imagine that. I'm pretty impressed that you're able to work with producers at all. So that's real progress. Now, people listening might get the feeling that the only work you do is really to reduce most of the horrific suffering in factory farming. But I was really happy to see that the other side of your work really is increasing veganism. I assume, though maybe I shouldn't assume anything, but I assume that would really be your goal and the others are steps perhaps towards that. But I'd really like to talk about that vegan work because I know everybody will be excited to hear about it. So one of the campaigns is called Feeding Tomorrow. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So Feeding Tomorrow is a program we have. We work with institutions, mostly universities and schools. So there are institutions that serve a large quantity of meals in their restaurants or canteens. So we ask them to go 100% plant-based once a week or twice a week. It is a new program. When we started, we were mostly focusing on reducing suffering only. But last year, we started working with this program in Colombia. And it was very successful. We got 9 institutions to commit, and together on a yearly basis, they will be able to replace around 1.1 million meals with plant-based ingredients instead of animal products. And given the success of the work in Colombia, we are now expanding the same program to Argentina, Indonesia, and Thailand. And we also have campaigns for consumers. So in all Latin American countries and in Thailand and Indonesia, We have vegan challenges. So we challenge people to sign up to our challenges, and they receive one email per day telling them everything they need to know if they want to have a plant-based diet. So in some countries, they receive emails, and in other countries, we are implementing a more interactive way of doing this. So the challenges take place in Facebook groups, and we partner with an organization called Challenge 22 on this campaign, and it is very exciting. We usually get around 2,000 new signups per country per month.
Wow. That's very impressive. So how do you feel about this promotion of veganism on the one hand and getting rid of some of the worst welfare violations of animals who are currently trapped in farms? Do you see these as having separate ultimate goals, or do you see this all as the same thing?
I think reducing suffering is really part of the solution. It's part of the way we need to move towards if we want to end factory farming. And that is because factory farming makes animal products very, very cheap. You know, you basically outsource all your costs on animals and on the environment. And that creates a kind of unfair competition because, you know, meat and dairy is becoming more and more cheap. And the same is not happening with plant-based foods. So I think when we implement animal welfare reforms, very often, most of the time, they will also mean that the production costs are going to be higher and possibly increasing the prices of animal products will also create more balance or will also make animal products less competitive, you know, when people go shopping. So I think bringing like economic balance to the situation is very important as well. I don't think we can allow animal products to be so cheap because they're just cheap because of the way they're being produced.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's such an important piece of the, there's so many different pieces to this puzzle, but that's such an important one. And particularly, I mean, in many of the countries you are working in, poverty must be an enormous factor in what many people can reasonably be expected to do vis-a-vis their diet. I mean, people are just trying to survive. So how do you work with people who are going to find this very difficult?
So basically, when we launch our campaigns, like the people we have in mind are mostly people from the middle class or the upper classes, because we know that these are the people who are spending more and more money on animal products. That's where we see the consumption growing. So they are our targets. We have never, so for example, sometimes people ask us if we don't want to work with rural or indigenous communities to lower their consumption of animal products in some countries. And the answer is no, because the problem is not really there. We see the problem in people like who have a growing level of income, who have enough to eat, and who are usually living in big cities. So these are our target groups. But having said that, I think what we also need to highlight is that, for example, in Brazil, over 70% of food production comes from small farmers, and they are not farmers who are raising animals. They are farmers who are raising fruits, vegetables, grains, pulses. So we see the change also creating a lot of development and job opportunities. So I think when we put everything into perspective, the social gains of having people eating more plant-based are very positive. I don't think anyone is going to lose anything when we see the change coming.
Oh, that's for sure. It's all gains. Why don't people understand that, Carolina? Why? Why? I can't. It sounds like the same all over the world. Also, a lot of people nowadays are making the point that, at least in some areas of the global South, high meat consumption is really an inheritance of colonialism. Do you think that's true? And does that argument have traction with the people you are trying to appeal to?
It is. It can be true in some cases. I think it is a result of colonialism. It is also a result of globalization, I think, because we are seeing diet habits spread across the globe very rapidly. But however, when I think about countries like Brazil and Argentina, for example, which are the countries where we have the highest consumption of animal products in South America, I also see a kind of a national culture, which is kind of the cowboy culture, you know, like the countryside culture, which highly encourages people to eat lots of meat. And I think that's something, it's national, I would say. I don't think it comes from abroad.
So one issue that you do see also, particularly in Brazil, is the enormous environmental destruction and the destruction of the rainforest and the devastation of indigenous communities and endangered species and really the eradication of a way of life. Is this an issue that motivates people that you're dealing with to consider not eating so much meat?
I think so. I think Brazil is very promising. So there is, well, first of all, there was a survey that revealed that already 14% of the Brazilian population considers themselves to be vegetarians. And that's very high. That's one of the highest in the world. And there's also a survey that pointed out that around 60% of Brazilians are willing to reduce their meat consumption. I don't think there is any specific survey or study that already indicates why people are willing to reduce their consumption of animal products. I have the feeling that the main issue there could be health, but we also have, of course, we have the Amazon in Brazil, which is very iconic and it's very important for all of us. And we know that 80% of new deforested areas in Brazil are being used for pasture to produce beef. And we also know that a lot of the deforestation happening in the Cerrado, which are the Brazilian savannas, is happening to produce soy to feed animals nationally or to export it abroad. And I think that has been happening for a long time. It's getting worse with our current government. And I think more and more people are getting informed. And I would guess that, yes, environmental problems are one of the reasons why Brazilians are willing to reduce consumption as well.
Yeah, and we're seeing a lot more attention paid to those issues here as well. But I'm wondering, what do you feel, and what do other Brazilians and people in the countries that you're dealing with feel about the obligations of the people in the global north around these issues? Because the Amazon is important to everybody, not just to Brazil. But maybe Brazil can't be the ones to fix it all.
I think it is a global problem and everybody should contribute. So, for example, I think Europe is a very important player. There was the soy moratorium some years ago where mostly European traders committed not to source soy from deforested areas in Brazil. With the current growing deforestation rates, there's also pressure from Europe that they will stop importing Brazilian products if the situation doesn't become any better. So I think it is a global problem. And especially when we think about soy, we export a lot of soy and it becomes animal feed in many different countries. So I think there are a lot of countries there that should be contributing. The challenge we face, however, with soy is that the largest importer now is China. And I don't see China being very concerned with the deforestation problem. But overall, yes, it is a global problem. It is a global issue. We know that the Amazon is responsible for controlling the water, the rain flows all around the world. So it should be treated as such. It should be treated as an international problem. There are some people who advocate for example, Brazil getting credits, carbon credits for not deforesting. There isn't anything defined yet, but surely an international problem, in my opinion.
So we're all responsible for what's happening everywhere. And one of the main reasons is because we are all eating meat, except for us. So I'm just wondering whether, I mean, what's seen as the big game changer here for the environmental problems, for all of the problems, but I think, you know, most of our listeners care about the animals in a really deep way. So the really exciting news seems to be these more sophisticated plant-based meats and even possibly cultured meat, which is already on the market, at least in one place, as being the ultimate game changer. Do you think this is possible, especially as the prices start to go down? Do you see this as a big hope, and how do you use them in your strategies?
Yeah, so what we currently say in our strategic plan is that we consider the two things to be a very important part of the solution. However, as you said, they're still very expensive. So for them to work, especially in the countries where we work, the prices need to drop quite significantly. But I think it is very clear that it's part of the solution, especially when we think about the need of people to cook quick meals. It is a reality. So we get people, for example, in big cities in Brazil, that, you know, they travel like 2 hours to go to work and 2 hours to come back. And when they come home, of course, they don't have time to cook, you know, a beautiful, wholesome, plant-based meal. And they will be looking for these solutions if they want to eat plant-based. So our hope is that the market is going to grow in scale. The products are going to become more affordable. Hopefully, the companies producing these options will also be very careful about not making them heavily processed, because we also know that can be a health problem if we feed people only with highly processed foods. But I think it is part of the solution, and we are very excited to see them coming. I think Brazil is a good example. The plant-based market is really booming here, and there are a lot of big companies that are producing alternatives, but there are also a lot of like small startups, which are exciting as well, and they're fully vegan.
Well, I think even the big meat companies are getting involved, right? I mean, including JBS in Brazil, which I think might be the biggest meat company in the world. I mean, it's huge. They're starting to invest in these meats.
Yes, JBS, it is the largest meat producer in Brazil and the largest meat producer in the world. They are producing a lot of plant-based alternatives. And I read last week that they're also investing or buying new companies to expand the product range. But we also have two other major players that are producing plant-based proteins, which are BRF and Marfrig. So yes, the big players here are very interested, and they can already see that they need to enter the market as soon as possible.
Yeah, I think that's the most exciting thing that could happen, even though none of us want to see those people making money. But, you know, if somebody's got to make money, at least let's hope they do it not off the backs of animals. And I'm just going to tell you one thing I always say about these foods being processed, which, you know, I think they vary, but I always think of meat as being a processed food because it's perfectly healthy food, like soybeans, processed through the body of an animal and turned into very unhealthy food. So that's how I counter that argument. But I do hope a lot of these foods will be good for people too. And I hope we can trust these companies to make that happen. A lot going on there. All right, I'm going to have to let you go, I know. But just before I do, we didn't even get into climate like, and how that's going to change everything. A lot is going to happen in the future. By the future, I mean the near future, to shift a lot of these things. So just let me ask you a shorthand question. Where do you see your work in 10 years?
Oh, where do we see ourselves in 10 years? There is so much to be done, but I would say that in the front of reducing animal suffering, I hope that we see enough progress with laying hands in the countries where we work with cage-free campaigns. And hopefully, instead of working with companies, we will be able to work with governments to implement legislation. And hopefully, we will have enough resources to also reduce the suffering of other species, because it's not only about laying hands. Yeah, I expect that we are see a lot of many more opportunities to promote veganism or at least increase our programs to reduce meat consumption. I think overall, most societies can recognize that we cannot be so reliant on animal products anymore. So I see a lot of opportunities for all the fronts we work with. And hopefully we will be working in more countries as well. Who knows?
Yeah, I certainly hope so. It sounds like you're doing amazing work. And it's really an unfair question, because the world is changing so rapidly that none of us really knows where we'll be even a year from now. And I actually misspoke before. I said we didn't even get to climate. And of course, we did get to climate. We didn't get to COVID, which is another enormously important issue. And there's just so much on a stake right now with animal agriculture, including the lives and the suffering of these billions of animals. So thanks for sharing. It's really been exciting to catch up with the work that you're doing, which I was unfamiliar with. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners were too. So thank you so much, Carolina.
Thank you, Marianne. It was great talking to you. And it's a great pleasure to be here and to be invited and to be talking to your listeners. So thank you so much.
Social media has become such an important part of almost all of our lives. So please make our hen house part of that social media experience for you. You can like us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter or Instagram. We try to post some news stories to help you keep up to date on what's happening in the world for animals. You can also find us online, of course, on our website, ourhenhouse.org, or you can email us. If you have some concerns or questions or something you'd like us to discuss on the podcast, let us know. info@ourhenhouse.org.
Anxieties are rising. We have some classics this week, all from meetingplace.com, all bringing back some of the arguments that they've been making for years, and all kind of pathetic. All right, first, ruffled feathers. This is from the For the Birds column by Christine Alvarado, who is in the poultry biz. And she starts off by saying that she is a big supporter of choices, especially food choices. Choice. They've been bringing out choice for years. You should be able to choose to be cruel to animals or be able to choose to be not cruel to animals. Like, you should be able to do what you want. That's not how they put it. She says this: I enjoy having choices when I go to the grocery store. Do I want a whole chicken breast or Milanese style or bacon-wrapped chicken breast? I guess that was a joke since she's in the poultry biz and she only gave chicken choices. She wants freedom. She wants to be able to get whatever she's in the mood for. And she also loves to choose based on cost when she needs to buy less expensive items. And the example she gives is conventional versus cage-free eggs. Conventional. Yeah, horrifying. If you want to see an angry Christine, actually, I don't want to see any kind of Christine if you want to be honest about it. But if you do want to see an angry Christine, take away my choices, especially my food choices. Then she points out that the fight from several consumer and animal rights groups is real. We're not alone anymore, guys. Consumers are on our side. They do not want us eating meat. I haven't seen that many consumers who don't want people eating meat, but I'm glad to know they're out there. And she does feel that, you know, if people want to have alt meat, that apparently is their new word for it, alt meat. I don't really mind that word. That's fine. They should have choice. But what she's talking about is not having any choices other than alt meat. And she cites the cage-free movement, which is a disaster to the egg industry, in her opinion, and a disaster for the chickens, in her opinion as well, because according to her, quote, the science has always indicated the cages were better for the laying hens. Like, I cannot believe they are still trotting out this crap. Like, have they ever seen film of a battery cage facility? She even has an egg carton from the 50s that promotes eggs from chickens in cages in order to keep them free from disease and free from predators. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Yeah, I'm not surprised that the industry was promoting it. They still are. All right. So her fight for keeping consumer choices is real. She wants to give some advice about what everybody should do now. Quote, we know that that reality without drama does not sell. We do not have a sexy story to sell. That's for sure. Like, I can't imagine anybody being less in the mood for sex after being in a battery cage facility or a chicken farm. We don't have an emotional story that pulls at the heartstrings to sell. That's for damn sure. However, what we do have is the safest food supply. Yeah, we're talking about the poultry industry here. Oh, my God. Like, if there's any industry that's going to take us all down, whether it's through disease or pollution or just sheer unadulterated misery, it would seem it would be the poultry industry. But, you know, she's in. She wants everybody to have that choice. They, you know, like I said in the beginning, they're just trotting out the same old arguments time after time, they still sound as pathetic as ever. All right, Farmer versus Farmer. This is from the Millennial Musings column by Brittany Bailey. She's in marketing, pork marketing specifically. She's upset about a commercial. I haven't seen this commercial. I had to go look it up. It's easy to find online. Silk, milk of the land. It's obviously a commercial for Silk. And they're talking about almond milk in it specifically. And she is very concerned about it because she believes it provides an interesting perspective and perhaps foreboding of a milk alternative brand featuring the farmer and the process to get to the product it is advertising. Now, why does she find this foreboding? Well, she's going to point out something that may be obvious. It's certainly obvious to me, and I bet it's obvious to you, but apparently it's, according to her, obvious, but maybe not often considered truth. There is still a farmer involved in the growing and production of alternative milk and meat products. Wow, what an insight. Yeah, it turns out animal rights groups aren't anti-farmer, even though they've been trying to position us as anti-farmer for as long as I can remember. We actually like to eat food. We actually like farmers who grow food, especially, well, only plant foods that, you know, not only serve us, but serve the world and serve the animals. And yeah, all right, I'm going on and on. Let me get back to Brittany. She thought about her own truth and experiences in witnessing the apparent divide between livestock farmers and fruit, nut, plant, whatever other kind of farmer. And this was when she first interviewed for this job, and they asked her if she'd ever been on a farm, and they were chagrined to find out that it was a plant. You know, it sounds like it was a soy farm or something that was making products for animals for slaughter, but not slaughtering the animals themselves. It sounds like she felt a little naive or whatever, but she had no problem visiting a pig barn. She just hadn't yet. And she points out that the activists have excelled at preying off this internal divide, pitting farmer versus farmer. In the first place, sadly, I don't think there is much of a divide. There's a divide amongst eaters. Farmer, like a lot of farmers, just, you know, they grow soy for factory farms and they make grow vegetables and whatever. But there is some divide, I guess. And we could say that some of these farmers are going to want to be increasing that divide because they don't want to be associated with slaughter and everybody loves what they're doing. And she says there will be some that will criticize Silk, who are not farmers, by the way. They're producing a plant-based product. So that will criticize Silk for using the word milk and claiming to be the milk of the land. I love that, milk of the land. Isn't that smart? Great advertising. Yeah, there will be some who will criticize them. It's you. You're the ones who are going to be criticizing them because nobody else cares. These same naysayers might criticize legume, i.e. pea or chickpea farmers, if they show up in an ad for an alternative meat product. But they earned that right to be called a farmer too. Well, yeah, they're a lot more farmer than pig farmers are with their big warehouses. Like, factory farmers are not farmers at all, in my point of view, obviously. She can see the Silk advertisement ruffling some feathers. Get it? Ruffling some feathers. They use that term a lot. But in the impending climate change battle, in the first place, is there something wrong with that battle? Are some of us for climate change and some of us against climate change? Isn't it more crisis? Anyway, but that's how they see it. They see it as a battle between the industry that is causing climate change and all of the people who would like to continue living on the planet. In the impending climate change battle, shouldn't we all band together to talk about how we're all caring for the land in one way or another versus roll our eyes at one's chosen crop versus another's? Well, no, you're not, because pig farmers are not caring for the land in any way whatsoever. And they're now going to be competing with plant-based products. And I don't see any reason why farmers who are growing food for people that is delicious and wonderful and serves us and feeds us should be sticking up for pig farmers. They're getting panicky. I'm going to have to change the title of this piece to Panic is Rising. All right, finally, also from Meeting Place, further quote, food for thought. And this is by Lisa Keefe, who writes the Center of My Plate column and is the editor of Meeting Place in print. She starts off by saying, taking a few quotes from Blue Horizons report, Food for Thought, The Protein Transformation, which, according to her, this is not a quote, but has scared the bejesus of the industry. These are the quotes. Quote, peak meat, quote, 11% of the market by 2035, quote, $290 billion. They are starting to wake up to how big the alt meat, as they call it, world is going to be. And as she points out, Boston Consulting, which worked on this report, is no veg evangelist organization. God forbid we should have anybody who is in favor of vegetables. And it says that this report makes a convincing case. And it's meant to, because it's trying to attract financial investment to alternative protein companies. But she says these projections are not necessarily real. They might be, as she says, more speculative than the headlines suggest. Among them is the report's most optimistic scenario that gives alternative proteins a market share of 22% by 2035. Well, I certainly hope we're ahead of 22% by then, but she seems to think that that's an extreme number. I hope it's a very, very mistake on the conservative side. But this depends on various things. And I think this is a wake-up call for all of us because they know what is going to influence whether this market is going to grow or going to die. The report assumes, she says, for example, that government regulators around the globe will make decisions in the years to come that will encourage the growth of the alt proteins market. And she says there's no guarantee those decisions will benefit alt proteins. Obviously, she would like to see the meat industry fight that and make sure that governments don't favor plant-based products. But the fight is on, you know. I think that's what they're saying. The fight is on. And so we better get working on it. The other area, of course, is labeling. She says alt meat companies argue that they can use terms such as meat or steak or burger on the label as long as it's clearly also marked as plant-based or other type of alternative, while opponents saying using such terms on an alternative product confuses customers. Well, most of the courts have said, consumers aren't quite stupid, that if you put plant-based all over it, they're going to think, oh, I bet this is plant-based. Most of the court decisions have been favorable to the plant-based products. And the final thing that apparently they feel they have to fight, or she feels they have to fight, is cultivated meat. She's talking about Singapore. Then she points out that Singapore faces a unique challenge in its goal to provide its own food for citizens in a country with a paltry amount of agricultural assets. It has to move fast. Well, yeah, that's true, that Singapore might have to move faster, but this is not a unique challenge. The ability to grow food for one's population is going to be a challenge in every single country in the world. And using fewer agricultural assets is going to be a huge, huge, big deal. So she's wrong on all these things, but the fight is on. And, you know, the meat industry has won many, many, many fights where they were wrong. So it's a wake-up call for us all. It's time to get political. And that's it for this week's Rising Anxieties.
Well, that's it for this week's show. As always, if you like the podcast, and if you're able, you can support us by joining the flock at ourhenhouse.org/donate for $10 a month or $100 a year, or you can make whatever donation you're comfortable with.
Another great way to support us is to leave a fabulous review wherever you listen to podcasts or on Apple Podcasts, or you can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter or Instagram at ourhenhouse. If you shop on Amazon, you can use Amazon Smile using Our Hen House as your favorite charity. And of course, tell your friends about us.
If you're one of our listeners who already supports us, thank you so much. I'm Jasmine Singer. Thank you to my co-host, Marianne Sullivan.
That's me.
And to Jen Riley for her work in producing this podcast, and to composer Michael Herron for the music. Thanks to Jocelyn Martinez for her work doing research, and for Eric Montgomery of Podcast Haven for his work editing. Thanks to Lori Johnston of Two Trick Pony for her graphic design services.
We will be back next week with a brand new show, so don't forget to subscribe in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you are a Flock member, remember to check your email or the Flock Facebook page on Tuesday for your bonus content.
Thanks so much for tuning in and for changing the world for animals.